Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602. Or toll-free across the United States, it's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And good afternoon. Welcome to The Dividing Line. My name is James White. We are sort of here today. We are live, but only barely. We're sort of running on 6 out of 8 cylinders. That's just myself. Everybody else seems to be fine. But we're putzing along here just barely, and so we're hopefully going to be able to bring you something worthwhile, and it's going to help that I did want anyways to play some sections of a debate, a radio debate that is available in MP3 format. I'm going to play certain sections of it, and the reason being that we are going to be in Salt Lake City next weekend. I can't believe it's coming up that quickly. I certainly don't feel prepared, but we're going to be in Salt Lake City at the General Conference of the Mormon Church, and the evening of our Saturday outreach, we're going to be engaging in a debate with Dr. Martin Tanner, a Mormon attorney, on the subject of deification, or specifically, can men become gods? I don't know if it's going to focus on the early church doctrine or just what it's going to be focused upon as of yet. So it depends on, I suppose, my opponent's opening statement. I intend to focus primarily upon the doctrinal teaching. But to be that as it may, I have been preparing, and one of the ways I prepare is if I have access to anything that my opponents have done in the past, then I will study that. If I have been on the air with them, for example, I will take the time to listen to the encounters that we've had before. And so what I've been doing is I have been listening to sections of some of the radio programs that I did back in the early to mid-1990s with Martin Tanner as the host of the program, but as one of the primary antagonists, as far as my position was concerned, along with Van Hale. And just to get you an idea of the flavor, the temperature, shall we say, of these particular programs, I'm going to play some sections, and you'll notice, and I would suggest you download all of 441 and 442 from our MP3 site if you'd like to listen to the two programs recorded 6 months apart. There's one section, I'm not going to play a section, where I can barely get a word in edgewise, and it is very, Mr. Tanner's frequently using terms like absurd and ridiculous and pretty much in your face type of a situation. And these, of course, are recorded in Salt Lake City, so you've got a situation where you're in Utah, and you are in a small radio studio. The host of the program's Mormon. You have a Mormon guest in the person of Van Hale. Then you have myself, and of course, and you're taking phone calls. Not exactly an evenly balanced situation, which is one thing I'm looking forward to in a debate, is we have even amounts of time. But as I was listening to these programs, I would record them in MP3 format, load them on MP3 player, and I was hiking Squaw Peak a couple days ago, listening to this program, and all of a sudden I hear this phone call, and I had it nice and queued up, and then I said, you know, there's this big blank spot down here. I'll go down there and delete that. Well, that moved the queue, so I'm going to have to play around to get the queue right again here. A phone call comes in, and I found it absolutely fascinating. You may recall from last week, the fact that we mentioned what has taken place in regards to Daniel C. Peterson. And Dr. Peterson is one of the main individuals in the organization called FARMS, the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies. And last week we played for you a section of Dr. Peterson responding to Bill McKeever on the subject of theosis. And in fact, let me just play you a little section of that.
I mean, this has already been responded to, and the fact that they keep bringing this up, regardless of the fact, is just amazing to me.
Well, I would say we keep bringing it up because it's true, and I'd be willing to go head-to-head with any of those people on this issue any day of the week.
Now, let's make sure everybody heard that. It didn't sound very loud in my headphones.
I'd be willing to go head-to-head with any of those people on this issue any day of the week.
Okay, so now, did you catch that voice? Now, I recognize that voice now, having been on the air with Dr. Peterson on KTKK, he and Bill Hamblin, and Ann Martin Tanner, again, the three of them versus me. And but when I was doing the radio programs we're going to listen to today, I had not yet encountered Dr. Peterson as far as having heard him speak. So imagine my surprise, and I don't remember now, this is over a decade ago, and you do so many radio programs and so many different topics and so many different things that I don't recall all the details anymore, but I do not have any recollection of ever having realized that in the midst of this rather raucous going back and forth with Van Hale and Martin Tanner, especially Martin Tanner, Van only once in a while gets really animated. It's Mr. Tanner that's mainly animated. As I'm climbing up Squaw Peak, I hear this call. Now, I remember the call. I remembered someone called in, Focus on Act 17. And remember, this is a program that started off with my specifically mentioning the Ensign article that appeared in 1988 that was written by Daniel C. Peterson and Stephen Ricks on the subject of theosis and deification. I had specifically written a response that included that particular Ensign article in it. And so I've mentioned Peterson. I have specifically refuted assertions that Daniel Peterson has made. So imagine my surprise as I'm crunching up the Squaw Peak to hear the phone call, and I realize instantly that Dan on the phone is Daniel C. Peterson. Here, a BYU professor is calling into a program where his own article has been specifically critiqued. He doesn't identify himself, does not try to rehabilitate himself, does not try to answer any of the criticisms that has been made of his material at all, but focuses on something else. Now, you know as well as I know that both Van Hale and Martin Tanner knew who this was on the phone. They knew this was Dan Peterson, just like Van Hale knew that it was Bill Hamblin that called in a few years later. And that started the whole discussion of John 10 and Year Gods and all sorts of things that it's on our website if you want to go there and look at it. The correspondence was prompted by a telephone call, a guy who identified himself as Bill. Well, it wasn't Bill, it was William Hamblin from Brigham Young University. So isn't it interesting that when you know, a little old Baptist minister comes up to Salt Lake City, that you have a Mormon attorney, a Mormon apologist, in a Mormon context, and BYU professors calling in, and then in not too you know, not too many years later, you've got Dan Peterson saying,
"I'd be willing to go head to head with any of those people on this issue any day of the week." I'd be willing to go head to head with any of those people on this issue any day of the week.
Yeah, and seemingly, but only in an anonymous way, because he came on the program here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to play you the phone call. And I'm gonna, it goes back and forth. It's quite lengthy. I'll play you the phone call, and then I'll play you the rest of that particular program. And again, you can listen to these downloading. This is specifically number 442 is the MP3 format file on our website. If you want to download that and listen to the whole thing, I'd suggest it to you. It is quite interesting. But now this isn't the professional way to do it. But like I said, I lost my cue when I tried to cut out a space later on. So let me see if I can find it here, and y'all get to listen.
This is with the father. So if you want to take it back to the occasion.
Oh, very close.
Dan, you're on the air with our guests.
I have a question for Reverend White. He's made a great deal of the gulf of the chasm between...
Okay, there it is. Boy, talk about a good guess. That's the beginning of the call. Listen to the voice. You'll see it's the same voice as we are playing in that other section where, of course, we hear... Uh-oh, where'd it go?
People on this issue any day of the week. I'd be willing to go head-to-head with any of those people on this issue any day of the week.
So that's Dan Peterson. That's his voice. And what we're going to hear here then is his phone call to Martin Tanner, myself, and Van Hale up in Salt Lake City. And you'll, I think, get the gist of what's going on.
God being the creator?
No. It's where Paul cites a pagan poet who says that we are God's offspring. And then
right.
He obviously quotes him with approval. What would you make of that?
Well, I think I gave an indication in exactly what I just said, that God, who made the world and everything in it, is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by hands, is what he says in verse 24. And so, yes, he speaks of the fact that God is the creator of all things, and that's how I understand the term Father. God is not a man, as we are men, Hosea 11:9 tells us. And it says, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone. In other words, we are created in the image of God. If we are not idols of gold, silver, and stone, then obviously God cannot be an idol of gold, silver, or stone either. We are created in the image of God. In that sense, you can be called an offspring. But that does not make God something different than what the prophets of Israel said, the very God who is the eternal creator of all things, who is spirit and who is omnipresent.
So offspring there has a very specialized definition that you could never use in any other context.
No, not at all. Not at all. Because for example, in the Old Testament, Israel is the offspring of God. Israel is called God is called the father of the people of Israel.
Yes.
But that obviously does not mean that God gives physical birth to nations.
Well, that's quite true. It's used in a metaphorical sense, but it does
as it is here.
Of the same type.
As it is here.
No. You may remember that the word genus, which is used there in the Greek, is related, in fact, to the Latin word genus, the same one that we use. And it means of the same type. It means race, descent, kind.
Well, I think you've just caused yourself a problem because, for example, the term monogenes, which is made up of monos and genos, that is used of Jesus Christ, says that he is the unique, the only begotten Son of God. Now, if you're going to force genos into that, what are you going to do with that meaning that he is the only one?
Now, genes doesn't have to do with genos. They're obviously related, but it's not the same thing. I don't want to get into a technical discussion of Greek terminology here, but all of the standard Greek dictionaries indicate that something that is of the same genos as something else, those things have something in common. They are the same kind of thing. I think you're not really dealing with that issue.
Well,
that's the issue that you raised through the whole program, and it simply breaks down when confronted with a verse like this.
Well, sir, God rebuked those who thought that he was like them in Psalm 50:21. You've got to read Acts 17 in the light of everything that has come before it, which includes the clear emphasis that God is not a man, that God is eternal, that he is the creator of time, and this idea that he is somehow creating beings of the same kind off of genos, I think, is reaching far beyond that. If you have one of the standard Greek dictionaries available to you, for example, the one...
You're right in front of me.
Okay, Bauer, Gingrich, and Donker, does it cite Acts 17:29?
No, I don't have that one. I have the Liddell and Scott. I can get the other one in a second, but I don't think I'll take the radio time to do it.
Well,
let me just tell you what it says here.
Can I ask you something?
Descendant.
Uh-huh.
Kind, genus.
Yes.
That's what it says. It does not say the relationship of light bulb to inventor of light bulb.
Okay, so what you're saying then is that that same term is used of God creating a planet. For example, in Psalm 90, verse 2, it says, before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. The word brought forth has reference, when used of humans, to birth. Are you going to be consistent and apply the same technical definition there and be extremely literal and say that God is actually a female who brings who gives birth to mountains and worlds?
No, because that's
going to another language.
The Greek term genos is used this way.
Uh-huh. Are you prepared to say right now that genos is never used in anything other than a physical relationship of the same kind, father and son?
No, I'm not. I'm precisely not.
It can be used metaphorically. In fact, you'd probably find it.
I'm saying that it means kind or genus. Mm-hmm. It says here, we are also his offspring. Now, I'm not translating it as offspring. I don't care about that. We are also his genus. We are of his kind. That's what it says. I don't say that it implies a physical relationship. I do say that it implies a qualitative similarity.
Well, wait a minute. Now, I think you've got to dig into this passage a little bit deeper and look, for example, at the verb that is used here and try to deal with what it. Are you familiar with the verb that's used there?
So I'm looking right at it. What verb do you have in mind?
Hipparchon.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say?
Well, what do you think it says? I'm curious.
Well, obviously, Paul, I do not believe for a second that Paul believed that we are gods or of the genos of God in that sense.
I realize you don't think that it means that, but it seems to me to mean precisely that.
Okay. And so would you say that would you say that the way I interpreted this passage when you first gave it to me violates the meaning of genos?
Yes.
That we are created in the image and likeness of God, that violates the meaning of genos?
Well, by the way you interpret image and likeness, yes, I think it does.
Well, I think that I interpret image and likeness the same way that Paul did. Because he said God is invisible. So what do you think image and likeness means?
Oh, Paul didn't mean by invisibility. The invisibility in theory, he meant invisibility in fact. That's a very easy thing to deal with.
A very easy thing to deal with? That he, when describing the nature of God, said that he is invisible?
Yes. We don't see him. Do you see him right now? I don't.
He dwells in light, unapproachable?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because, well, we haven't seen him. But wait a minute. I thought Joseph Smith saw him, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Well, that means he's not invisible, does it?
You know all the argument on this. I'm not going to get into this.
So did Moses and many other people.
God is an easy one.
Could I invite you, if you would be willing, and if Martin would allow me to do so, for me to give out my address and to correspond with me on the meaning of genos?
I would certainly be glad to correspond with you on the meaning of genos.
Could I give that address out, Martin?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, you could write to us at Alpha and Omega Ministries.
Mm-hmm.
And the post office box 47041, let me repeat that. That's post office box 47041, Phoenix, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And the zip code there is 85068.
Mm-hmm.
That's 85068. I would very much like to correspond with you on the meaning of genos in Acts 17 and dig into, you mentioned that you'd be willing to talk about the definitions, the words, dig into Bauer and Gingrich and Donger, Kittle's Theological Dictionary, et cetera, et cetera.
So I'm quite willing to do that.
Good. I'm looking forward to hearing from you.
I'd like, by the way, to take the occasion to deny something else that you've been assuming all along, which is that God is the creator of all things ex nihilo. That doctrine is not attested before the second century in anything like clarity.
Oh, I think that's very untrue. I think you'll find it, first of all, in the Jewish sources very strongly.
Where, Philo?
Well, I wasn't even including Philo in that, but it is clearly said in since the context that I said it was in regards to the early church fathers. Obviously, before the second century, what you're saying is you do not find it in Clement, Ignatius, or Irenaeus, or maybe possibly a couple others. I'm sorry?
When do you date Clement?
Oh, well, I was talking about Clement of Rome.
Okay.
Not Clement of Alexandria.
You don't.
You don't find it in Irenaeus?
Nope, you don't.
You do not find it in Melito of Sardis?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, and if you saw these things, I'm getting knocked across the room here at the moment, and if you saw these things, if they were sent to you?
Well, if I saw them, I'd want to know how you interpreted them. I doubt that they're there. I'm thinking particularly of a correspondence, or excuse me, an exchange of articles between a couple of people at Journal of Jewish Studies a few years ago, who are far greater authorities on creation ex nihilo than I am, but who placed the invention of the doctrine sometime around AD 160 by your favorite patient.
Well, actually, I'd place it in Colossians, or I'm sorry, Isaiah chapter 40 as being a very clear evidence of it.
No, I'd absolutely deny that.
Well, you can deny it. I just like to invite the listeners to read Isaiah chapter 40 through 48 and see if they don't find out there for themselves. Think that's fair?
They should know, though, that the consensus informed opinion right now among scholars is simply that the doctrine does not exist in the Bible.
I totally deny that and ask them to look into it for themselves.
Okay, well, I would suggest anything by David Winston, who is a professor at the Graduate Theological Union at Berkeley, who probably represents the greatest authority on the subject right now.
And I'd like to suggest that Dr. Kaiser from Trinity Evangelical Divinity School on the subject of the Old Testament, the doctrine of God there.
Well, I hate to say it. I hate to play academic status games, but he just doesn't write against Winston.
Well, if you want to feel that way, that's fine, but...
Anyway, I think it should be said for those who are listening that in terms of reputable, scholarly, accepted academic opinion outside of theological seminaries where their theological axe is to grind, the idea is this doctrine did not exist among the early rabbis, among the writers of the Hebrew Bible, or even among the writers of the Greek New Testament.
And I'd like to add that amongst most scholarly opinion outside of theological schools, there is no God, virgin birth, or salvation either, if you wanted to go that far.
Well, we're not talking about that kind of an issue of faith.
Oh, I think we are. Right. And I wouldn't identify that as an issue of faith. That's just not simply an issue of faith. That's an issue of truth.
Let me just suggest this, that what you've been saying is you've been assuming as if this is something that we just all had to go along with. That is not true.
Assuming what, sir?
That creation ex nihilo was done.
No, I mentioned...
That is absolutely rejected by the majority of commentators.
Excuse me. I mentioned creatio ex nihilo in reference to the very same early fathers that we were citing in regards to deification. Please try to be accurate.
No. You also used it with reference to the interpretation of the hermeneutic of Acts 17.
Oh, yeah.
It's applicable.
Yeah, I believe it's clearly in Paul.
Well, no one else sees.
All things are made by him and for him, and he is before all things, out him, all things.
Faith does not imply creation.
There are lots of things that Reverend White has disagreed with us and the scholars on this evening. So I guess we'll leave it there.
Please, don't give me that. They are said to be biased.
Whoops, sorry about that. I am going to a second thing here. I want to hear the end of Peterson's call.
Statement of fact, James. That is a statement of fact. There are many things that you've disagreed with. First of all and foremost is the parallels, the striking parallels between the Mormon concept of deification and that found in the writings of the early church fathers.
Okay, we'll pick up at that point, but aside from Martin Tanner's, Reverend White, he's disagreed with us and the scholars on lots of things tonight. Listen to the whole thing, and you'll discover that really doesn't have a whole lot in the way of merit. And for those in the other room, we'll need to take our break early because I'm going to start a second section here in a moment. But imagine for a moment that you have written an article and published an article, and someone comes on the air and they criticize your article and they refute your article, and you call in and you just give the shortened form of your first name. You do not announce who you are. You do not address the criticisms that they've addressed of your article, and that's exactly what you just heard. I cannot imagine what it would be like to be Dan Peterson and to call into a program like this in an anonymous fashion, as he did, and not even respond to the criticism that was leveled against your own article. Absolutely amazing. And even more amazing to me is Martin Tanner and Van Hale sitting there knowing full well who this was and not saying a word about it. Very, very strange when I realized that call had come from Dan Peterson. At that point, things go back and forth between myself and Martin Tanner for quite some time. And you will hear them making reference to a single, a single citation of Ernst Benz. Now, I go back and I discuss what Ernst, what that particular citation is actually about. We'll play that section. But, then we'll move it back later. So I'm going to play that section and let you hear the back and forth that took place between myself and Mr. Tanner on that particular subject.
Statement of fact, James. That is a statement of fact. There are many things that you've disagreed with. First of all and foremost is the parallels, the striking parallels between the Mormon concept of deification and that found in the writings of the early church fathers.
If you want to ignore basic foundational things, fine. But don't say that I'm disagreeing with scholars, Martin.
If you would like to, that's fine, but you are disagreeing with scholars, and I will make that statement again.
As are you. You realize that the entire Mormon position disagrees with 99.9% of all Christian scholarship in the world.
That is an absurd statement on the face of it.
Oh.
On this area of deification and on any other and on any other subject, that there is a 99-point-any degree of difference.
Okay.
That is absurd. The parallels between all brands of Christianity are far more striking than the difference.
Let me ask you, how many scholars would support the changes Joseph Smith made in Genesis chapter 50, and that, in fact, would support the Joseph Smith translation?
Do you believe that that's 99%, that 99% of the Bible was changed by Joseph Smith?
What does that have to do with what I just asked you?
You said that over 99% was not the same, was not parallel in any way.
No, what I said was that 99% of Christian scholars would disagree with, as an example, Joseph Smith's quote-unquote translation. I use the term very loosely because I don't think he was translating anything. For example, of inserting a prophecy about himself in the 50th chapter of Genesis. Can you name me any scholars outside the LDS faith that believe that Joseph Smith's quote-unquote restoration of Genesis chapter 50 has any basis in historical reality whatsoever?
As a translation?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No, but I would be willing to say that 99% of them have never even looked into the matter either. And so
it's interesting, when scholars do look into it, then all of a sudden they are said to be biased because of supposedly being anti-Mormon. I've had many conversations with Mormons, for example, where when a scholar has made a statement on something relevant to the LDS faith, well, he's got a bone to pick.
Well, and when we brought up a source earlier this evening where, my word, a scholar finds striking parallels.
Mm-hmm. I asked if he was LDS.
Yes, and
is
he wasn't.
Is that improper?
No, that's fine, and surprised he wasn't. How do you account for that change?
What do you mean surprised he wasn't? I wanted to know if he was LDS because I've seen some writings that are tremendously
biased. Did you assume
biased.
He was LDS?
No, I did not. I wanted to ask if he was.
How do you account for the parallels that he found and the fact that he was not LDS?
I disagree totally with him. With the application that has been made of the doctrine of deification in, for example, the Ensign or in Robinson's book, if you want to just say, well, yes, there are totally and completely foundational differences. The early Christians would never, ever have viewed their doctrine of deification the way we do, but there are still parallels. If you want to say
Van
that,
and
that's
I said,
fine.
Van and I said something very close to that in the first 3 minutes of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there are some substantial differences, although you continue to fail to accept the striking and numerous parallels.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. If you want to call them striking and numerous parallels, the simple fact of the matter is
we'll let our listeners decide.
We
talked about joint heirs, about thrones, about mm-hmm. judges, divine nature, about authority, all those other things, about becoming the very image, about being made in God's image, and
yeah,
about
we're made
being
God's
one with
image.
Him, and all
we
those
agreed
other things.
With all those things.
And yes, and you don't see any of those as parallel.
And then I
see none of those as parallel.
Well, since the early church fathers didn't define
are
God
any of those
by
parallels?
Those things, Martin.
Are, oh, really?
Since
none
they
of
didn't
those
define
things,
God
none
by
of those,
those
things,
things
have anything to do with
let,
God?
Let,
that's an absurd statement.
Martin,
those very things
Martin,
are used to describe
let,
God, and those very things
Martin,
are used to say
let
how
me,
we will become like him. How can you say
you.
That those things don't define God? How can you say
the
that?
The early fathers defined God by some of the following things. Creator of all things. Do they ever say that men will be the creator of all things?
No.
Yes no?
No. And
do they
neither,
ever
neither
say,
do Mormons
do they
say
ever
that
say,
we will be the creator of all things,
okay.
And neither do the early church fathers.
Then you just made my point for me, that they obviously, clearly do not have in the concept of deification the idea that men will become gods in the way that the LDS believe that we are of the same species of God.
Nobody,
do they ever say that they are to be worshipped?
Nobody
that they will be
says,
prayed to.
Nobody says that that deification as LDS believe it is exactly 100% the same as the early church fathers. We've said that there are striking parallels. You have pointed out a few differences.
Sorry. I'm sorry, but if those differences are absolutely foundational, you as an attorney know that any good argument, if you're attempting to make a parallel, you have to deal with the foundations.
Let me go ahead and stop it right there, and we will pick up with that rather interesting back and forth between myself and Martin Tanner. And at the end of this program, I also read the actual citations they say that I had ignored and demonstrate that those citations disproved their point and proved mine. And we'll continue on the dividing line right after this.
Can I manufacture grace for self-denial in some religious place? By weeping hard on your face and saying prayers to some dead saints you know.
The history of the Christian Church pivots on the doctrine of justification by faith. Once the core of the Reformation, the Church today often ignores or misunderstands this foundational doctrine. In his book, The God Who Justifies, theologian James White calls believers to a fresh appreciation of, understanding of, and dedication to the great doctrine of justification, and then provides an exegesis of the key scripture texts on this theme. Justification is the heart of the gospel. In today's culture, where tolerance is the new absolute, James White proclaims with passion the truth and centrality of the doctrine of justification by faith. Dr. J. Adams says, "I lost sleep over this book. I simply couldn't put it down." James White writes the way an exegetically and theologically oriented pastor appreciates. This is no book for casual reading. There is solid meat throughout, an outstanding contribution in every sense of the words. The God Who Justifies by Dr. James White. Get your copy today at aomin.org.
More than any time in the past, Roman Catholics and evangelicals are working together. They are standing shoulder to shoulder against social evils. They are joining across denominational boundaries in renewal movements. And many evangelicals are finding the history, tradition, and grandeur of the Roman Catholic Church appealing. This newfound rapport has caused many evangelical leaders and laypeople to question the age-old disagreements that have divided Protestants and Catholics. Aren't we all saying the same thing in a different language? James White's book, The Roman Catholic Controversy, is an absorbing look at current views of tradition and scripture, the papacy, the mass, purgatory and indulgences, and Marian doctrine. James White points out the crucial differences that remain regarding the Christian life and the heart of the gospel itself that cannot be ignored. Order your copy of The Roman Catholic Controversy by going to our website at aomin.org.
This portion of The Dividing Line has been made possible by the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. The Apostle Paul spoke of the importance of solemnly testifying of the gospel of the grace of God. The proclamation of God's truth is the most important element of His worship in His church. The elders and people of the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church invite you to worship with them this coming Lord's Day. The morning Bible study begins at 9:30 a.m. and the worship service is at 10:45. Evening services are at 6:30 p.m. on Sunday and the Wednesday night prayer meeting is at 7. The Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church is located at 3805 North 12th Street in Phoenix. You can call for further information at 602-26-GRACE. If you're unable to attend, you can still participate with your computer and real audio at prbc.org, where the ministry extends around the world through the archives of sermons and Bible study lessons available 24 hours a day.
Now the Pilgrim's Progress is not an easy way. It's a journey through the sun, day by day. Following Jesus, it's a walk of praise.
And welcome back to The Dividing Line. My name is James White. We're listening to myself and Martin Tanner sort of going at it back in the early 1990s on the subject of deification. In light of the upcoming debate this weekend at the University of Utah up in the Salt Lake area, and we are doing so you can sort of hear some of the interesting things that took place. We've listened to a call from Daniel Peterson, who did not identify himself as Daniel Peterson.
I'd be willing to go head-to-head with any of those people on this issue any day of the week.
Yeah, that's the Daniel Peterson we're talking about.
I'd be willing to go head-to-head with any
head-to-head
of those people on
yes,
this issue
yes.
any
yes.
day of the week.
We can't get him to do that, though. That's what he said he'd do, but he won't. And we're listening to Martin Tanner and I going back and forth on that. If you would like to call and participate in the sense if you've got some questions about some of the things you've heard. And sort of in this general topic area, if possible, then 877-753-3341 is the number. You might want to wait for a little bit closer to the top of the hour because the next section that we're going to be playing is a little bit lengthy, hopefully useful to you. And so let's continue on.
Deal with the foundation. Since the foundations are completely different, since the early church fathers defined God in regards to his eternity and creation,
are
and
you
never
telling
speak
me,
of men in that
are
way.
Are you telling me that the LDS concept of God is in no way similar to the early Christian view in your view?
Yes.
That there's no parallel?
No parallel.
None whatsoever.
No.
You believe that God's all-knowing. You believe that he has all power.
Yes.
Great. We've got a few parallels, don't we?
No.
How do you account for that?
LDS God does not have all power, sir.
Not in the Christian sense.
Well,
was there a God before him?
Do you believe
that was there a God before him?
I don't know the answer to that. I believe that he was there from all beginning, and so for eternity. Now, if you say that, listen, if you say that, you have to say in what sense, because in a very real sense, LDS people believe that God always has been. You fail to acknowledge that.
Has he always been God?
Has he always been God?
He's
self-existent.
He was never begotten.
No.
He never lived as a man on another planet.
Was he
born of parents?
Yes.
Was he God at that time?
No.
Then he cannot have eternally been God. Are you self-existent?
In a very real sense.
Okay, so what you're saying is you're self-existent and God is self-existent. The early fathers have said that you are self-existent?
Somewhat, yes.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
In a sense that God is self-existent?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you're asking me to try and...
Could you tell me who said that?
You're trying to get me to speak for the early church fathers the way you want to speak for them, and the fact is there are foundational, very foundational differences between what you believe and what the early church fathers believed. Foundational differences.
You want to point out all the
there
differences
is no difference
between
in the
Latter-day Saints
God is eternal
and early Christians, but you want to just sweep under the rug all the differences between
Martin, I don't appreciate that. I'm not sweeping anything under the rug. That is an unfair statement.
That is not an unfair statement. You have presumed to speak for early Christians.
On one point. And I've documented that, and you've agreed with the point.
No.
That's not true.
Yes, it is true. What was the point that I spoke for the early fathers? That God was genetos, he was without beginning and origin and source. And you agreed that that's what they had said.
No, that isn't exactly what I said. I disagreed with you.
I'm glad this is being taped.
I disagreed with you.
Because then we can go back and listen.
We can go back and listen, but let me just refresh your memory. I made the point that the early church fathers did not all agree with you on the idea about that there is no possibility for a person being God except for the Father.
I didn't say that. First of all, the point that I made in representing the early church was that they believed that the being of God is agenikos, without origin, source, independent, and self-existent, and that he is alone in that van. He is alone in that. I stand by that. In fact, I would be willing to come back up here to Utah at your leisure, and we'll find a place to do it, and we'll go for 3 hours in a scholar debate with moderator and go for exactly what the early church fathers taught in regards to the fact, is God self-existent or is he not?
Well, I believe God's self-existent. That's not the point. We've agreed on that. We've agreed on it 100 times.
And that's what I said.
You keep going back to that as a veil for the point that I'm trying to make.
Not a veil at all.
Yes, it is.
It is.
No, it's not.
I think you were acknowledging. I mean, you're kind of nodding your head and so forth. I was pointing out that many of the early church fathers believed that there was a point in time when a person became a person who is now God. Prior to that time, was not God, and I'm making reference to Jesus.
They did not believe that Jesus Christ was God in the sense that God is God.
That's right. That's right. That's my point. Okay, we agree.
Whole point. How about that?
Okay, that's a foundational difference between your position and their position.
A foundational one, James. A foundational one. Can you accept that?
Okay.
You have a foundational difference between the early church fathers.
Not the early church fathers, Martin. a few unorthodox early churches.
They're unorthodox because they don't agree with
who were they?
They're
name
unorthodox.
Them. Name them right now without any help. Who were they? Right now, Martin.
I can't name them.
So you don't even know who we're talking about, do you? What did
Origen
say?
Ask you the question. You address Van's question rather than trying to.
You
ask
jumped
me
in
this.
On me and attacked me and said I was out of line with the early church fathers. I want to know from you.
I believe you are.
Are you just believing what somebody else is saying, or do you know this of yourself?
I'm believing what somebody else is saying. Address your
Let's say Origen said that God was Hatheos and Jesus was Theos. He did not use the article of him. Okay, we've got Origen. Now, I don't think you're going to want to buy into Origen because you probably know enough about Origen not to want to touch
him. It doesn't matter whether I want to buy into anybody or not. I don't buy into any of them, as I told you in the first place.
The point being that it was not the majority opinion of the early fathers. Let's stop right at 300. Are you going to tell me that it was the majority opinion of the early fathers that there was a point in time in which a man became God?
I'm not talking about a majority. I'm saying that
he was.
I'm saying that the
earth. Not.
You said the. You said I disagreed with the fathers. If that's not a majority, if it's one or two.
Some.
Okay.
Fathers, plural. Fathers, plural.
One or two.
No, right? Fathers, plural. Sure.
We're not all.
I never said all. Okay. Don't put words in my mouth either.
Okay.
We're not talking about one or two. We're talking about a very substantial debate and controversy that raged for a long time. We're not just talking about some little unorthodox person. We're talking about something that was basically splitting.
Let's start with Ignatius.
Well,
was my view of...
I don't want to start with Ignatius.
Why
I just
not?
Want, because we've got 4 minutes left, and I just wanted to make a general statement.
Okay, go ahead and make a general statement.
The general statement is that the historians of Christian doctrine have, in large numbers, expressed a consensus type of opinion that the concept of the Trinity, which ties into all of this, was not something which was known in prior to the 4th century, the beginning of the 4th century.
I find it Ignatius. In the New
Testament. You can think you find it in Ignatius, but it's not there.
Well, I think
That requires an interpretation of Ignatius.
As does the statement that it's not there, right?
Well, of course it does.
Okay, so they're both interpretations.
But the statement doesn't require an interpretation to say that there is no statement of the Trinity in the New Testament or in Ignatius. He does not,
not as a formal doctrine.
He does not make a statement of the Trinity.
No, he just bases his thinking on it.
You can say that. I mean, you can blurt that out. That would be an interesting point to discuss and debate. It would be something that we wouldn't be able to establish one way or the other, because it's easy to state the Trinity. It's very easy to state the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity. Paul could have stated it. Jesus could have stated it. Ignatius could have stated it. None of them did. And in fact, you know, in all of them, there are statements which simply don't fit well with the Trinity.
Well, obviously, that's a whole other subject.
I know it is.
If we have a second to make a closing statement, I would just like to make a closing statement that all the materials that I sent up upon which we were going to discuss made one point. The point is that the early church, as we have all agreed, I'm not even going to say that. I'll just make the statement and allow people to discover it for themselves if they wish to do the research on it. The early church fathers who taught the doctrine of deification, and they were not the entirety of the people, but the early church fathers who taught the doctrine of deification taught that God had eternally been God and never been anything other than God, that he was without origin, without source, and hence any attempt to parallel a concept that we can become gods, that we can inherit the same power and the same exaltation as Joseph Smith said in the King Follett Funeral Discourse and teachings of Prophet Joseph Smith, cannot be made a valid parallel because it differs on a foundational level. If a person wishes to sacrifice the meaning of the term parallel and just say, well, I see things that are similar, sure, their beliefs are totally different, but there are similarities, then of course those parallels can be drawn. But I do not believe that is an accurate or scholarly way of dealing with the early church fathers.
Okay, let me summarize my thinking in one statement from Gregory of Nazianzus, in which he says this: for a cause he was born, referring to Jesus, and that cause was that you might be saved, while his inferior nature, the humanity, became God because it was united to God, and became one person because the higher nature prevailed, in order that I too might be made God so far as he was made man. I mean, there's an incredible statement being made there, and those who are interested in reading the writings of the early church fathers are going to find incredible parallels between what they're saying about men's opportunity for deification and what the Latter-day Saints are saying.
And the same Gregory said, God always was and is and will be, or better, he always is, and goes on from there. I'd like you to look at everything Gregory said.
No debate about that.
Well, there is debate about that, but anyways, we're going to take a. I'm going to stop right there and explain this next section because it'll sound differently. There have only been a few times when I have taken something and added in a commentary at the end, and as I mentioned earlier in this particular program, Van Hale had quoted from Ernst Benz, and I didn't have this source. I didn't have materials in front of me, so there really wasn't much I could do about it. But when I got back from Salt Lake City, I took the time to do some research. And so in this next section, we've certainly gotten more high-tech over the years than we were back then. I sat down with one of our ghetto blasters, that's what we called them back then, and recorded the following comments in regards to the citation that had been given to me. And I think it's interesting because it sort of reveals the kind of activity, the kind of, I don't know, not research, but the kind of, what word am I searching for? The willingness to utilize information that is found within the apologetic communities, shall we say.
Being with us this evening.
2 weeks after the previous program aired in Utah, we began our missions work at the LDS Easter pageant in Mesa. A Christian brother from Utah came down to share the gospel during that event. In speaking with him, he told me that he had listened to Religion on the Line and then informed me that the next program was entirely devoted to the exact same topic, this time without any Christian representation. I was not invited to provide further comments with reference to that program. Upon returning to Phoenix from Salt Lake, I visited the local LDS bookstore and purchased the book Reflections on Mormonism, from which Van Hale had cited Ernst Benz's comments. The listener will recall that it was commonly asserted that I was in conflict with Benz in regards to the position I took with reference to the beliefs of the early fathers. Upon reading Benz's article, I was only mildly surprised that what Benz said was not exactly the way it had been presented on the program. Here is the quotation and the context given by Van Hale.
Not, but he doesn't come out in the quotations that you cite. But what Ernst Benz has done is he has, after a lifetime of study of the history of Christian doctrine and the writing of a number of books and articles and so forth, he also studied the LDS doctrine.
Mm-hmm.
And he's making a direct comment. He's doing the same thing that you've done. He's looked at the LDS doctrine. He's looked at the early church fathers. And he comes away with a different point of view than you do. Okay? And let me read it to you. He says, in no other Christian doctrine is the connection between God and man so closely conceived, the idea of man as the image of God so concretely and literally interpreted, man brought into such close proximity to God, and God, on the other hand, so strongly directed to man as in Mormonism. One can think what one wants of this doctrine of progressive deification, which is a term that he uses to define, to describe the LDS doctrine. He says, one can think what one wants of this doctrine of progressive deification. But one thing is certain, with this anthropology, Joseph Smith is closer to the view of man held by the ancient church. Athanasius, the great bishop of Alexandria, the head of the church in all Egypt, summarized the Christian doctrine of salvation in the words, God became man so that we may become God. The goal of salvation is deification, and Athanasius invokes in this context the words of Jesus, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect.
What did Benz actually say? First, we know that he opens his 17-page article with a discussion first of Augustine's doctrine of the Imago Dei, the image of God, and then contrasts this with the views of the Christian mystics. It is these mystics that Benz will refer to when comparing LDS theology. Next, in defining LDS theology, Benz goes against most modern LDS teachers, but follows Joseph Smith closely. He says, quote, beginning at page 210 of the book, but what was God in the beginning? The Mormon's startling answer to this question is that in the beginning, God was man. His relationship to the universe is the same as man's relationship to the universe. He attempts to rationally form the given universe and make it useful to him. Since he is subject, like man, to the law of progression, This has to mean that, and then he quotes, God must have been engaged from the beginning and must now be engaged in progressive development. And infinite as God is, he must have been less powerful in the past than he is today. It is clear also that, as with every other being, the power of God has resulted from the exercise of his will. As knowledge grew into greater knowledge by persistent efforts of will, his recognition of universal laws became greater until he attained at least a conquest over the universe, which to our finite understanding seems absolutely complete. We may be certain that, through self-effort, the inherent and innate powers of God have been developed to a God-like degree. Thus, he has become God. That being a quote from John Widsoe's Rational Theology. He continues, this naive formulation of that which Schelling made the basis of his natural theology, the doctrine of theogony, presupposes that the form in which God undertook the progressive organization of the earth was the human form. Universally accepted among the Mormons is the idea that God has attained his present state of godhood through his own efforts to organize the universe. In place of the God of conventional Orthodox churches, who has always been complete, Mormonism knows of a God who has attained by his own activity, by progressive creative organization of the eternal material power-laden universe, a relative dominion over the world, a task which in no wise is complete and which needs further refining by means of more eternal progression. The universe is not yet complete. God has not yet attained the highest degree of his godhood. He has accomplished a great deal since he engaged as an exalted man in the organization of the universe, but he has yet much to do. Progression is infinite. End quote. Here we have a direct assertion by Bentz that according to Mormonism, God is still progressing in all aspects of his being, a belief decried by Mormon Apostle Bruce R. McConkie. Even Van Hale asserted that God's being has not changed relevant to our time period. Note as well that Bentz identifies this concept as naive, and that he clearly sees that it is foreign to the Orthodox concept of God. Bentz continues his article by discussing various corollaries to the LDS conception of deity. He speaks of the LDS concept of marriage, and then of birth control. It is in this context that the quotation provided by Van Hale is found. However, Mr. Hale left out a great deal from the quotation he read. Here is the quotation in full. In no other Christian doctrine is the connection between God and man so closely conceived, the idea of man as the image of God so concretely and literally interpreted, man brought into such close proximity to God, and God, on the other hand, so strongly directed to man, as in Mormonism. The thought of apotheosis in mysticism, which expresses itself there in the idea of the spiritual divine birth in man, and in the spiritual procreation of the Son in man, and in the progressive deification of man, has been translated here into a theology of evolution and progression, where the path that man travels from his prehistoric to his earthly form of existence, to his future corporeal mode of existence in the kingdom of heaven, is understood as the path of eternal progression, determined by the great plan of God, which makes possible man's ascent to godhood. It is not the path, however, of the lonely celibate mystic, but the way of a great and ever-growing family of saints in whom the creative, conscious organization of the universe is perfected. One can think what one wants of this doctrine of progressive deification, but one thing is certain. With this anthropology, Joseph Smith is closer to the view of man held by the ancient church than the precursors of the Augustinian doctrine of original sin were, who considered the thought of such a substantial connection between God and man as the heresy par excellence. We must remember here that for the ancient church, salvation stood in direct correlation to embodiment. Athanasius, the great bishop of Alexandria, the head of the church in all Egypt, summarized the Christian doctrine of salvation in the words, God became man so that we may become God. The goal of salvation is deification, and Athanasius invokes in this context the words of Jesus, be therefore perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect, Matthew 5:48. Note that Mr. Hale's quote skips the entire point that Bentz is comparing the LDS view with that of apotheosis in Christian mysticism. He further states that the Christian mystic's view is translated into a, quote, theology of evolution and progression, end quote. In other words, he admits the clear differences between the two concepts, even in the doctrine of deification itself. Next, we note that Mr. Hale left off in the middle of a sentence and skipped directly to another sentence in his quotation, leaving a false impression that was very important to the arguments presented by the defenders of Mormonism for the rest of the program. Mr. Hale's quote went like this.
LDS doctrine. says, one can think what one wants of this doctrine of progressive deification. But one thing is certain. For this anthropology, Joseph Smith is closer to the view of man held by the ancient church. Athanasius, the great bishop of Alexandria, the head of the church in all Egypt, summarized the Christian doctrine of salvation in the words, God became man so that we may become God.
However, the actual quotation goes as follows. One can think what one wants of this doctrine of progressive deification, but one thing is certain. With this anthropology, Joseph Smith is closer to the view of man held by the ancient church than the precursors of the Augustinian doctrine of original sin were, who considered the thought of such a substantial connection between God and man as the heresy par excellence. We must remember here that for the ancient church, salvation stood in direct correlation to embodiment. Athanasius, the great bishop of Alexandria, the head of the church in Egypt, summarized the Christian doctrine of salvation in the words, God became man so that we may become gods. Now, in all fairness to Mr. Hale, we should point out that a year earlier, on the same program on KTKK in Salt Lake City, when Mr. Hale read this passage, he did include that section later on in the discussion. Not when he first read it, but he did go back and add that in. And at that time, we did not discuss the subject to the depth that we did in this program. Finally, we note some of the closing comments of Bentz's article. Now, this idea of deification could give rise to a misunderstanding, namely that it leads to a blasphemous self-aggrandizement of man. If that were the case, then mysticism would, in fact, be the most sublime, most spiritualized form of egoism. But the concept of imago Dei and the Christian understanding of the term precisely does not aspire to awaken in man a consciousness of his own divinity, but attempts to have him recognize the image of God in his neighbor. What a contrast between that and these words from Mormon Apostle George Q. Cannon. Men talk about evolution. This is the true evolution, being such as we are and developing, advancing, and progressing in that upward and onward career until we shall become like him, in truth, until we shall possess the powers that he possesses and exercise the dominion that he now exercises. This is the promise that is held out to us. What is there more helpless, weak, puny, insignificant, it may be said, in many respects, than a human being when it is born into the world? Yet this being, if nurtured properly, if trained as it should be, has before it a career of never-ending glory. That little puling infant may become in the eternity of our God a God to sway power and dominion in the eternal worlds, to be the father of unnumbered millions. Yet at its birth, who would anticipate such a future for it? He also said, we hear considerable about evolution. Who is there that believes more in true evolution than the Latter-day Saints? The evolution of man until he shall become a God. That is the gospel of Jesus Christ, believed in by the Latter-day Saints. In closing, we find nothing in Bentz's article that would dispute what we asserted from the beginning, that being that the Mormon concept of God is so far removed from the view of the Bible in the early church that the attempt to make a parallel between the concept of theosis in the teachings of some of the early fathers and the LDS concept of eternal progression is improper. The attempts by LDS writers such as Robinson, Peterson, and Ricks to deflect Christian criticism of LDS teachings by attempting to draw a parallel between the patristic doctrine of theosis and the LDS concept of men becoming gods is without merit.
Yes, indeed, it certainly is without merit, and that, of course, is, as I said, available on the website on our MP3 server page if you'd like to download that.
I'd be willing to go head-to-head with any of those people on this issue any day of the week.
Okay, we've heard that. We want to do that. Right?
I'd be willing
to stop that. sorry, hey, I'm not the one that said it. You know, if I said that on a radio program in front of hundreds of thousands of people, I'd probably, you know, go through with what I said that I would do. So I think it's perfectly fair that we repeat what was said in that situation. 877-753-3341, 877-753-3341 is the phone number. If you have some questions concerning that particular encounter or the subject of deification, the LDS doctrine of God, after this break, it will be your opportunity to call in at 877-753-3341, and we will continue with the Dividing Line right after this.
Godly man, such a rarity today. So many stars, strong and true.
quickly fall away.
What is Dr. Norman Geisler warning the Christian community about in his book Chosen But Free? A new cult? Secularism? False prophecy scenarios? No, Dr. Geisler is sounding the alarm about a system of beliefs commonly called Calvinism. He insists that this belief system is theologically inconsistent, philosophically insufficient, and morally repugnant. In his book, The Potter's Freedom, James White replies to Dr. Geisler, but the Potter's Freedom is much more than just a reply. It is a defense of the very principles upon which the Protestant Reformation was founded. Indeed, it is a defense of the very gospel itself. In a style that both scholars and laymen alike can appreciate, James White masterfully counters the evidence against so-called extreme Calvinism, defines what the Reformed faith actually is, and concludes that the gospel preached by the Reformers is the very one taught in the pages of Scripture. The Potter's Freedom, a defense of the Reformation and a rebuttal to Norman Geisler's Chosen But Free. You'll find it in the Reformed Theology section of our bookstore at aomen.org.
Millions of petitioners from around the world are imploring Pope John Paul II to recognize the Virgin Mary as co-redeemer with Christ, elevating the topic of Roman Catholic views of Mary to national headlines and widespread discussion. In his book, Mary, Another Redeemer, James White sidesteps hostile rhetoric and cites directly from Roman Catholic sources to explore this volatile topic. He traces how Mary of the Bible, esteemed mother of the Lord, obedient servant, and chosen vessel of God, has become the immaculately conceived, bodily assumed Queen of Heaven, viewed as co-mediator with Christ and now recognized as co-redeemer by many in the Roman Catholic Church. Mary, Another Redeemer, is fresh insight into the woman the Bible calls blessed among women and an invitation to single-minded devotion to God's truth. You can order your copy of James White's book, Mary, Another Redeemer, at aomen.org.
Incorporating the most recent research and solid biblical truth, Letters to a Mormon Elder by James White is a series of personal letters written to a fictional Mormon missionary. Examining the teaching and theology of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the book brings a relational approach to material usually presented in textbook style. James White draws from his extensive apologetics ministry to thousands of Mormons in presenting the truth of Christianity. With well-defined arguments, James White provides readers with insight and understanding into the Book of Mormon, the prophecies, visions, and teachings of Joseph Smith, the theological implications of the doctrines of Mormonism, and other major historical issues relevant to the claims of the LDS Church. This marvelous study is a valuable text for Christians who talk with Mormons and is an ideal book to be read by Mormons. Letters to a Mormon Elder. Get your copy today in the Mormonism section of our bookstore at aomen.org.
Welcome back to The Dividing Line. My name is James White, and we've been listening to a debate that took place. Well, it wasn't a debate. It was a radio program. Debates, you generally, you know, don't just talk over each other. But radio encounter that took place up in Salt Lake City, somewhere around 91, I think, because as I recall, I mentioned something about having been going up to conference for 7 years, and that started in 84, so that would be somewhere around 91, somewhere in that particular range. And very interesting program. Again, you can get that on tape. If you're into the low-tech way of listening to things, you can get it on MP3. If you're into the high-tech way of listening to things, really wouldn't be much good on a video because it wasn't videoed and it really wouldn't be overly exciting anyways if it was. But we certainly do hope to be offering all those forms of the debate coming up this weekend as well. And no one has called in at 877-753-3341. One of two things is going to happen. Either we're going to call it a day early today because, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, we were not exactly running on 100% batteries today. Or Warren and I will start singing, and since I don't feel that good anyways, my singing is not going to be very good. And so the combination of Warren and I, me sick, and then Warren, and I'm not going to say anything more about that, would be a really bad things. So someone just asked when Steve Camp was coming back on. That would be nice. I talked with Steve this week. In fact, I suppose I should kind of sit here and chat with y'all. Preached at Grace Bridge at Grace Community Church this past Wednesday evening. That is the adult, there's a bunch of stuff going on at John MacArthur's church on a Wednesday night, but this is primarily the adult get-together in the worship center. And I had the opportunity of preaching behind the hydraulic pulpit. I've always thought that was really cool. Boy, as soon as I threatened to have Warren start singing, the phones start ringing. Anyways, I got to preach behind the hydraulic pulpit, and their pulpit comes up out of the ground. That's really not all that unusual, I've discovered. There's a lot of LDS wards and even some Jehovah's Witness Kingdom Halls that have hydraulic stuff like that. But anyways, I always thought that was sort of cool. And wonderful time, great folks over there. Got to meet a number of the seminary students. And what was really neat, and I forgot to tell Mr. Pierce about this, I had a... new seminary student come up to me. I think he was a seminary student. Yeah, he was a seminary student. It wasn't master's college. It was seminary. And he was from Georgia. And he had the Georgia accent going on real well. And I informed him that I had preached in Forsyth, Georgia, back in July. He knew where that was. But anyways, he was extremely thankful for... our work. He had read The Potter's Freedom and things like that. And then he had gone to Russia over the course of the summer and had run into LDS missionaries and had logged on to our website from the Soviet, well, it's not Soviet Union, but from Russia to get information on witnessing to the Mormons there in Russia. And he was able to utilize that information with those Mormon missionaries. So I thought that was really cool that the information that we've produced over the years is being used in places like that and by high-quality individuals as well. So met a lot of neat folks who were very supportive of the ministry, very supportive of what we're doing, and a lot of encouragement to continue on. Most folks know that I'm in the midst of the debate issues, the back and forth debate issues with Dave Hunt. Not debate issues. Let me clarify this. The book that we're writing, Mr. Hunt and I finally got some of his opening stuff. I don't have all of it yet. And I can't give you a lot of details, but it's going to be interesting. Let's put it that way. And I think you all are going to find it to be very, very, very interesting when it comes out. But a lot of folks encouraging us, knowing that that's not an easy subject to be addressing. And, of course, we have the debate coming up, two debates coming up in the first weekend of November with John Sanders on inclusivism and open theism as well. And so someone had suggested finish explaining the answer to last week's last caller on Hank's use of Romans 5 and the atonement, etc. I've not heard Hank Hanegraaff address Romans 5. I don't know what he's saying. I know that he doesn't believe in particular redemption or things like that, but I've not heard what he says about Romans 5, so there's really no way I could do that. But we do have one person who evidently either just really dislikes the possibility of solos by Warren and I, or has a real question. That's James down in Denton, Texas. Hi, James. How you doing, James?
Good. How are you?
Doing all right.
I had a question. You mentioned the book of Genesis, chapter 50.
Yes, uh-huh.
You said that Joseph Smith made an addition to that?
Yeah, I'm looking around here. Unfortunately, I put my quad back, and so I don't have it in front of me. And there comes Rich to get for me. But he inserted a number of verses in which he includes a prophecy of himself and places this in the words of, as I recall, Joseph. Let me see here. I now have it. Let me see if I can find the... material for you here. Specifically, it would be wherever they put the Joseph Smith translation. Here it is. It's specifically Genesis chapter 50. If you do you have your Bible open to that, perhaps?
I can get it.
Oh, that's all right. I just you'll notice that Genesis chapter 50 in the real Bible, anyways. ends with verse 26. So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. A coffin?
Yeah.
A coffin in Egypt. But according to the LDS, his Joseph Smith's version, their Genesis 50 goes all the way through verse 38. So there is an added 12 verses that have been inserted in here. Of course, there is no foundation. Nothing has ever been found anywhere in the entirety of the world to substantiate this. But it is, for example, verse 26. A seer shall the Lord my God raise up, who shall be a choice seer under the fruit of my loins. Thus saith the Lord God of my fathers unto me, a choice seer will I raise up out of the fruit of thy loins, and he shall be esteemed highly among the fruit of thy loins. We were just having a discussion of redundancy in the chapel, in the channel, and here's a good example of redundancy. He shall do a work for the fruit of thy loins, his brethren, and he talks about the name Joseph and the whole nine yards, and that's what is inserted into Genesis chapter 50.
What was his basis for adding this?
That he's a prophet.
Oh, okay.
See, prophets can do that kind of thing. It's there doesn't have to be any historical basis. It doesn't have to be any manuscript basis. He's a prophet, and if God speaks to him and says, stick this into Genesis chapter 50, just because it happens to be a prophecy that's fulfilled in him doesn't mean anything at all. You just do it.
So Mormons would claim that this was the Holy Spirit ministered to Joseph Smith, and he felt compelled to do this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, that's exactly right. Now, the vast majority of Mormons I know of don't even know about that. I mean, it's in their scriptures, in the sense that, now it's not in their scriptures. If you go to Genesis 50, in their current issue of the scriptures, you'll see a footnote that will refer you to the Joseph Smith translation appendix in the back of their King James Bible.
Yeah.
And that's where you'll be able to find it. But I would say the majority of Mormons with whom I've spoken, probably were not even aware of that, and I don't find a lot of Mormons that pay a whole lot of attention to the Joseph Smith translation, which I find interesting. I certainly find it very interesting because of the fact that I think it gives us a way of testing Joseph Smith as an alleged prophet, and the changes he made are consistently against the alterations he makes in John 6 and turning the entire meaning of Romans 4 on its head and things like that. The Greek manuscripts do not support that kind of thing. And so the Joseph Smith translation, I think, is a good test of Joseph Smith as a prophet. But most Mormons today just don't invest much time in it. And I haven't found it to be a real big issue amongst LDS apologists either.
Okay.
So that's the addition he made.
Okay, well, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. God bless. Mormons are pretty much King James only. That's one of the questions that was asked in channel, but not the way that King James only folks are King James only. It's the official translation. It's the one they're familiar with. And it used to be, anyways, that Mormons would utilize the, if you use different translation, well, that demonstrates the Bible's been changed, etc., etc., etc. But that's changing. That's starting to break down, and Mormon writers are willing to use other translations of the Bible more often, and not in official stuff, but things like that. I know Van Hale loves to use different translations of the Bible all the time, and so that's starting to break down. And I don't know what the official position of the church eventually is going to be, of course, but I think over time that's probably going to break down. It's hard to say. So, 877-753-3341. I should probably just leave this quad right around here someplace. A quad, of course, for those of you who are not into constantly witnessing to Mormon folks, is the Book of Mormon, Doctrine, Covenants, Pearl of Great Price, and the King James Version of the Bible bound together, including Topical Guide, Bible Dictionary, and Joseph Smith Translation as well. So the thing is thick. It is a it's a weapon, especially in the full-size versions. When you use the handle on the cover to swing it, it would be a pretty nasty weapon if you I hear that they are willing to use the Warren translation. Well, that's only the small polygamist Mormon group in southeastern Utah. There's about 12 of them that are willing to use the Warren translation now. And that was only because Warren paid them in crisp meat burritos to do so. Some of you have no idea what in the world I was just talking about, but that's okay. It's all right. I'm just reading what's on the screen in front of me, and someone had told me that the Mormons were now willing to use the Warren translation, and I was just commenting on that. I see that JS4JC has a triple. That's very nice. I have a triple. In fact, I have about six triples of various and sundry sizes, all of them leather-bound, of course. And let's see, reading some other things here. Someone was hiding their New World translation. That's a whole other subject that we really don't want to get into here. Hold on just a second. I'll look over here. Oh, I don't see any lights flashing, so I don't know. That are you warming Warren up out there? Is that the idea? Let's see. You're ready? Let's see. What are your suggestions for what we should sing? Wasn't the 50th anniversary? What was the anniversary recent? Was it 25 years of the king's death? Was that what it was? Or 20 years? I can't remember. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. You know what? To be honest with you, I'm going to have to admit I'd have to have the words, because after like the first line, I'm lost, because I didn't grow up listening to Elvis. Now, I will tell you. Here's what I can do. Here's what I can do. Let's see here. Take a break. Thanks, Walter. Isn't that pretty? Dr. Oakley, what exactly did the early fathers mean when they referred to us becoming God? Well, that was part of the discussion. I'm actually bringing something up here while I'm doing this. That was part of the discussion prior to the section we played. I tried to explain some of their ideas, that they were basically differentiating man from any of the rest of creation, the fact that we'd be fully redeemed, united with Christ, sharing the divine nature. But the point was, and I repeated this, I had to repeat it many, many times, was that God, in their theology, had always been God, and hence to say that there's a parallel between the LDS concept and what those early fathers that mentioned Theos, is primarily in the East, meant would simply be ridiculous. And I had to repeat that over and over and over and over again, and Mr. Tanner just never did quite, really accept what I had to say, of course, as you certainly heard in that discussion. But anyways, if you want to know, here. I didn't grow up listening to Elvis. That really wasn't allowed in our I know you didn't hear the beginning, but that's because we didn't play the beginning, and I mentioned that you might want to download the whole thing. It's number 442 if you'd like to have a full discussion of that particular thing. The debate on open theism. Randy wants to save everyone from my singing. I don't understand that. Oh, there's a light over there. Well, just hold on a second. Debate on open theism. Oh, okay. You mean Randy in Colorado? That Randy in Colorado? Yes, okay. All right, well, hold on just a second. I didn't grow up listening to Elvis, but I did grow up. I would actually go to sleep, and my parents would be playing on an 8-track. Yes? An 8-track, you remember those? Remember those? Right in the middle of a song? It was just such high-tech stuff. 8-tracks. Anyways, I would go to bed listening to what I still think is one of the greatest voices of all time. Really, really is. So just indulge me for just a moment. Here's a really good example of what I think is one of the greatest voices of all time.
When I fall
Some of you don't know who that is. Sadly, I bet you there's a lot of folks, especially in the chat channel these days, that are so young that they don't even know what Du Bois is. I'm so you this fellow who is so mysterious. We don't know who he is. And in fact, his host mask does not resolve to a usable host mask. Got it right. Nat King Cole. What a tremendous voice Nat King Cole had. Just incredible. And that's a beautiful song, too, When I Fall in Love. But anyways, that is not what we're here for. In fact, I'm being told that Randy in Colorado says we should stick to apologetics and skip the singing. Well, that's fine. That's fine. Some of us are multi-talented, okay? And that's just all there is to it. So let's go ahead and talk to him. You know, I don't know why we should after a comment like that, personally.
Well, I think you're putting words in my mouth.
Well, I'm just reading what's on the screen. If it appears on the screen, it must be true.
And that's Warren distorting things again.
Well, you know, he does have that tendency.
Well, I see he's bitter because this is the second time I've called in to spare the world his singing. And I think he's eager to make his debut. What Warren doesn't know, probably, I never told him this, but I actually do music reviews on the web.
Cool.
So if he ever gets that CD done, you know, I'll see what I can do.
He just told me that Randy and I need to talk.
Hey, I just caught the tail end. I was about to leave for a party. My hockey team won a championship last week. And,
yay. What's hockey? Is that a sport?
It's a great sport. Hey, you got Phoenix over there. You know, you've got,
we do?
Got a team.
Oh, okay.
It's my old hometown team, the Winnipeg Jets.
That's right. The Winnipeg into the first round, out the first round Jets.
Yeah, unfortunately. But they, you know what? They probably had... Well, I hope this isn't related, but they probably had more Christians than any other team.
Really? Wow, great, wonderful.
I know of two, so.
Cool.
Yeah, but anyway, getting back to the true topic at hand, what is the date of your John Sanders debate?
That would be November 1st and 2nd.
Okay, so before ETS.
Yes.
Because he will be speaking at ETS, and so he may be... Who knows? He may be quite stunned by the result of the debate and just have a whole new anti-open theism speech at ETS.
I sort of doubt that personally. Remember, he's the his response to where was be wary of where, and he was one who used the evangelical Taliban comment last year. So he's, it's
well,
going to be
actually the stronger one last year was, my mind slipped, the old guy.
Pinnock.
Not Sanders, but his older mentor.
Clark Pinnock?
Clark Pinnock. He was ranting about evangelical mullahs mounting jihads against him. But I was wondering if you had that opportunity to read Terence Teason's book yet, in preparation for this, The Providence and Prayer.
No, I actually got it at your recommendation, and up until... last few weeks I've either been working on Hunt and then this debate on Mormonism, and so once this weekend is over, then the next 4 weeks are going to be nothing but preparation for that and really doing nothing else than that, which means I'm even going to have to put the Hunt replies on hold, which is really difficult for me to do. Now that I start getting them, I want to you know, respond to them. But I'm just gonna have to be patient. And
what's the status of the Hunt debate book?
Well, I've gotten 5 out of the 7 opening statements. I had turned all my 7 in over a month ago, and I wanted to have Mr. Hunt's material prior to going on our cruise, but I wasn't able to get it. I got it about an hour before I had to leave to speak at Grace Community Church in Los Angeles Wednesday. So I threw them all onto my handspring visor and read them on the flight. And as I said, there's someone on the air by the name of Rush Limbaugh who goes, "I've got a big I told you so today." And then he, you know, ruffles some papers in the background and that kind of stuff. And let's just say that it's a big I told you so. It's very, very much what you would expect.
Predictable.
Very, very predictable. And I think that... the contrast of the two is going to be extremely striking. Let's just put it that way.
Oh, sounds good. Well, of course, the open theism one's interesting to me because it's been such a large topic. topic, and not only at ETS, but also in several friends. I've had several run into several people who've had churches going that direction.
Mm.
And although I had somebody claim that that was something for stuffy old theologians and wouldn't impact the real world and was a waste of time, within a year I had two families I knew of in churches that had gone that route. So
yeah, no, it's it's unfortunately, because it does appeal to the senses of man, and the idea of it certainly allows you to find a way around God's sovereignty and around God's decree. No, it's not going to just stay in there. Besides that, you've got people like Boyd, anyways. I would agree that Sanders and Pinnock's books are not really good at communicating, shall we say. But Boyd is writing on a level that, especially because he's written books on other subjects that people pick up and read, he's writing on a level that communicates to the average person in the pew. And therefore, it's going to go that direction.
Unfortunately, I think it's something that will keep mounting. Also, on the Mormon side of things, I don't know. I just tuned in when you mentioned your quad, of course. have you run into, you know, with going to see the Mormon, going to the General Conference and whatnot? It seems to me that there's been a growing trend for Mormons to continually attempt to, shall we say, wear evangelical clothing.
Oh yeah.
Are you seeing that when you go to conference, that there's more of that, to that aspect?
Oh yeah. I mean, Mormonism is definitely trying to mainstream, and there's no question about the continuation of that effort, and where it's going to lead, I don't know, because it is impacting their scholars. It's impacting really all of Mormonism, and resulting in a diminishment of emphasis upon certain doctrines and so on and so forth. I really I don't know where that is going to where that's going to end up going. I don't think anyone can predict what Mormonism is going to look like 10 or 20 years from now. But there's definitely, you know, they for example think the open theism stuff's great. That's right down their alley. Even though I was talking to a Mormon fellow that affirmed exhaustive divine foreknowledge recently, which was very interesting. So, anyways, hey, you know, Martin's calling from England, and it's costing him a bunch of money. So let me talk to him really quickly. Thank you for saving us from, you know, I don't want you, Randy, to feel like it's your responsibility.
Okay.
But I think Warren may want to talk with you when I'm done here. So,
well, rather than responsibility, I look at it as a joy, a privilege.
Sort of like giving your blood to save the world against some sort of terrible disease.
Yeah, something about being willing to die to save others or something. I'm not sure.
Thanks, Randy.
We'll talk to you later.
All right, God bless. Hey, let's see if we can if Warren can lift his wounded arms far enough to get Martin on here real quick. Martin, are you there?
I am, James.
Hi, how you doing, Martin?
I'm doing very well, thank you, James. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing just great. You know, we were talking this morning about, you know, how it's getting cold there in England. You don't want to ride your bike anymore, you know?
James,
I'm sorry, is that a bicycle?
James, you sound more Australian than English.
Oh, no! I'm sorry, I'm doing my best, you know. No worries, mate.
Oh, goodness.
You do sound, that little goodness part, you know, that sounds just like Colin. You know, Colin,
okay.
Oh, goodness, that, you know, it's just, it's so cute. Anyways, so, Martin, what brings you on to the dividing line today?
I can't get over your Australian accent. A quick question, really. Witnessing to a few Mormons a little while ago, and they had a video regarding what they claim to be LDS archaeology, and it was to do with the Mayans and Mesoamerican archaeology.
Yep.
Have you seen that, and are there any responses to it?
Yep. Yes, in fact, I think that particular video, unless they've changed it, has been discussed by the Tanners in their book, Archaeology in the Book of Mormon.
Okay.
It's pretty common stuff. It's not even the farm stuff. It's not even what you might call the quote-unquote better stuff. It's the really bad stuff. I'm a little surprised they do that. They don't generally do that in the United States. They have really been pushing the Jesus video that they did instead. So
right.
I'm a little surprised that they brought... Was that one of the first ones they showed you?
They're talking to a friend, but yes, I mean, that was one of the first ones I showed him.
Interesting. All right. Well, I hate to tell you, Martin, but I can hear the music right behind me right now, brother. And so I'm going to have to go and let Steve Camp sing here and say goodbye to all of you. Thank you for calling and see you in 2 weeks. Bye.
We must contend for the faith of Father's Sparkle. We need a new Reformation Day. It's the sign of the tide. The truth is being trampled in a new age paradigm. Won't you lift up your voice? Are you tired of playing religion? It's time to make some noise.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-0318 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org, where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Saturday afternoon at 2 p.m. for The Dividing Line.